Hello and welcome to another episode of our Out of the Archives podcast. I'm Caroline Jones, the Wellington College archivist, and today I'm going to be talking about something which happened just over 101 years ago, and that was the Orange Dormitory Fire. It was the biggest fire we've ever had in the college's history, but you'll be pleased to hear that the most serious injury was a dislocated thumb. So the fire broke out on the 9th of March, 1919. As I say, about 101 years ago, about now. Now, of course, it had always been important in college to have fire precautions in place. You may not know, but the two towers in the main college buildings contain water tanks, not for drinking water, but to provide a reservoir with water pressure in case fire broke out. And all the buildings had fire hoses equipped to be tapped from those tanks. In 1919, the college had had its own fire engine and fire brigade for 40 years, since 1879. It was a small pumping engine, and various members of the college staff and students were trained to operate it. However, it wasn't enough to tackle a large blaze on its own. So I'm going to read the account of the fire, which was published in the Wellingtonian. But first, you need to understand which dormitories were where at that time. The Orange occupied the upper floor of what's now the Harding in Back Quad, and the Beresford was below it, also in Back Quad. The Blucher was in the upper part of its present location in Front Quad, and the Anglesey was below it. The fire occurred on a Sunday, but remember, in those days there was no weekend leave, so the whole school was here on site. However, it was very lucky that the fire broke out during the day, so that no one was in the dormitories when it occurred. The account in the Wellingtonian is as follows. On Sunday, March the 9th, occurred the first serious fire known at Wellington. At 1:38 p.m. the alarm bell rang. There were several masters on the scene immediately. The school prefects left the dining hall at once. Flame and smoke were pouring from the tops of three windows of the Orange. The burning rooms were on the side facing the Combermere quadrangle, about 20 yards from the south end of the dormitory. The two hoses belonging to the Orange and Blucher were rapidly got to work from the Orange landing. The dormitory was pitch dark. Smoke poured out. There was no sign of the actual flames, which appear to have been in the roof. The fire spread fast towards the tower and burnt directly over the landing. The smoke was choking. There was a danger of the roof collapsing. The landing was abandoned. The masters and prefects got the hoses from the west wing, so the block on the other side of the quadrangles, playing from the quadrangle and from the roof of Great School. At the same time, the college servants had a hose working on the roof of the master's library, while many OWs gave valuable assistance. Telephone messages had been sent to 8 fire brigades as soon as the alarm had been given. 2 in Aldershot, 2 in Reading, Frimley, Wokingham, Broadmoor and Guildford. At 1:55 p.m. the Wokingham engine arrived. By 2:05 p.m. the college engine was working vigorously in the Combermere quadrangle. The other brigades arrived during the next hour. There soon was evident danger of the fire spreading by the old hall, that's Waterloo Hall, to the west wing. The wind was south, inclined slightly to the west. A jet from the hydrant on the south front kept the east end of the old hall cool. So they're playing water onto Waterloo Hall to try and stop fire spreading along there. The fire in the Orange had reached the tower. The whole dormitory was blazing. Debris crashed into the quads, burning beams, window frames, lead tops of ventilators. Some of the prefects had a hose out on the corner of Great School. The water pressure was rapidly decreasing, and the jet only just reached the windows. The heat was tremendous, the smoke blinding and choking, the stench appalling. Red-hot cinders were thrown out over the roof and quads. Although the Orange landing had been evacuated almost at the beginning, a hose was still playing into the Orange from the door of the Blucher. By 2:30 the Orange was gutted, and fire broke through into the Beresford, i.e. the floor below. A few minutes later the Blucher caught near the tower. It seemed as if the fire would demolish the Blucher. Mr. Perkins' house, that's a housemaster who lived near there, was cleared of furniture and valuables. By this time, the engines were all working, chiefly drawing on the reservoir at the foot of the drive, though one worked from the Swan Lake. The brigades had 5 main pipes and 6 jets working on the front quad. There were 4 college hoses. In the Combermere quadrangle, there were 3 pipes, 2 from the college engine and 1 from a hydrant. By 3:15, the fire was subdued, and by 3:45 was well in hand. Till 3 p.m, all members of college had been kept in the dining hall. That may surprise you. Normally, nowadays, we would get people out of the building, but they obviously decided that the dining hall was safe enough. And apparently the boys were locked in there largely to stop them trying to retrieve their possessions from the burning dormitories. When they were let out, boys watched the proceedings from the south front, the upper half of the Combermere quad, and the north front. The crowd of onlookers was swelled by parents and by the population of Crowthorne. At 4:15, it was evident that the fire would spread no further. This being so, the master aimed at maintaining the ordinary routine as far as possible. The chapel bell rang from a smoking tower. The bell was in the tower which was on fire, so somebody must have gone up there to ring the bell. And the evening service seemed normal, except for the asthmatic pantings of the college engine outside in the quad. At 6 p.m. the fire brigades began to leave. The Aldershot and Wokingham brigades remained. At 7:15 a jet was still playing on the Blucher. From that time on during the night, there were intermittent, sporadic outbursts of flame. Fire kept breaking out round the ventilator shafts, where the draught blew as if up a chimney. At 8:15 the hose was playing on the centre of the Beresford roof, at 9 on the Blucher. There were some 20 small outbursts during the night. At 11 p.m. the Aldershot engine went away, leaving 5 men to help the Wokingham brigade, which stayed all night. Monday morning saw a melancholy desolation. At 7 a.m. a gentle rain was falling. Smoke still rose from the centre of the Beresford roof. There was the steady sound of water dripping and trickling. Water soaked through the floors into the classrooms, streamed down the stairs and flooded the cloisters. The shell of the Blucher stood precariously. One looked up through the Blucher windows straight into the sky. Now that the morning had come, it was possible to estimate the damage. The orange had gone entirely, except the sham chimneys and their iron stays dangling aimlessly in the air. In the Blucher, the damage was much less. Nearly all the partitions were intact. The roof had all fallen in, and the way along the dormitory was blocked by rafters, laths and twisted iron. Half of the Beresford roof had collapsed between the beams. The floor was 2 feet deep with debris, and the place was drenched. The Anglesey was untouched by fire, but water covered the floor 1 inch deep. Water poured from the ceiling and down the walls. From 8 to 8:15, the smoke burst into flame on the Beresford roof, and a hose worked on it from inside. At 9 a.m, the hose was turned onto the Blucher, where the fire showed signs of reviving. After that, there were no more outbreaks. The Wokingham Brigade stayed during the morning and left at 2:15 p.m. Members of college as a whole regarded the event with the calmness that one would have expected. The press was well represented. Photographers for the Daily Mail, Mirror and Reading Standard were conspicuous. The members of the burnt wing slept on Sunday night, some in the sanatorium and some in the classrooms under the Combermere. So that's where the master's office is now. On Monday, sleeping accommodation was arranged in the gymnasium, what we call the old gym, and the Anglesey beds were taken for the purpose. Some of these were taken downstairs, but the majority were slid from the balcony down a ladder with a rope. The old hall was turned into a common room for those who had been burnt out. The burnt buildings were watched all Monday night. The night was divided into 3 shifts of 3 hours each. A master, a prefect and a college servant were on duty during each shift. Many suggestions were made as to the origin of the fire. The first idea was that a fused electric wire was the cause. This was disproved, for the fuse box was intact and the wires themselves were in steel casings. The practical significance of the many conflicting rumours on the subject is that there is absolutely no evidence to go on, The cause of the fire is unknown and will probably never be known. So, as we've said, the fire meant that over 140 boys had lost their dormitories and everything except the clothes that they stood up in. As the report said, they were accommodated elsewhere, initially in the old gym, sanatorium, and other houses. As soon as possible, the master contacted the War Office, who erected temporary iron huts along South Front to house those students for the rest of that term and the summer term. The yearbook later commented that, for the rest of the term, the fellows in those dormitories had to put up with great discomfort. They had the old hall as a common room, but otherwise had to scratch along with a modicum of clothes till the end of the term. They accepted the present disaster in the spirit on which one may always count in dealing with Wellingtonians. One small plus was that at that time, students mostly kept their sports kit and their CCF uniforms in the changing rooms, not in their dormitories, so at least they still had those. The yearbook reported that during the next fortnight, men were at work cleaning the debris, and the chapel quad presented a wonderful sight of masses of distorted beds, burnt timber, and piles of unrecognisable rubbish. Within a week, a special committee of the governors had been formed to oversee the rebuilding, and that was carried out with remarkable efficiency. The Anglesey were back in their quarters by the summer term, and the other three dormitories were completed by the middle of October. On the 20th of October 1919, the master wrote to the college's vice president, Lord Derby, "You will like to know that the rebuilding after the fire is now completed. As I write, the last scaffolding poles are being taken down. The new dormitories, with fire-resisting partitions, new paint, and much improved bathrooms, look very attractive and are much appreciated by the boys." So in a way, the boys in those dormitories actually benefited, as they got more modern facilities when their dorms were rebuilt. That's all for today. I'll be back in another couple of weeks with a different story out of the archives.